And this begins the fourth section of Megillat Esros. And what we did is just to recap. At the end of last time, we left off on a bit of a cliff because we had done we'd worked through the conversation and the journey that Naomi and her daughters-in-law take, or all of them almost take, and the discussion in which Naomi tries at two different points to dissuade her daughters-in-law from joining her. She succeeds. With Orpah, Orpah turns around, whereas Rus cleaves to her. Rus stays with her target. And we had pointed out at the end of last week that that in the second conversation that Rus demonstrates her the degree of clinging, or the degree of seriousness that which is expressed in the famous words about her dedication to Naomi. Now, the questions that we have on the table that we need to cover today, a little bit more inside and but mostly outside of the actual booklet itself, is firstly, when was that conversion? Analyze it. We've been through the Pesukim. It sounds like the discussion between Naomi and Rus is the discussion itself of conversion. It sounds like that is what's going on. Is that at this point in time, the question on the table is, should she or should she not join the nation of Israel? And Naomi's trying to dissuade her. Rus adopts it. Now, that is the opinion that is adopted.
That also assumes that Naomi doesn't know that Rus can't
convert. Right, so we have lurking in the background, and this was mentioned, Malcolm mentioned a few weeks ago actually, is that lurking in the background, there is this halakha, which that the nation of Israel is not allowed to marry Moabites or Ammonites. And at the same time, as we saw in the first shir, that there is a halakha that only applies to the males, not the females. But to what degree was that known, or being made known at this point in time, is not clear. Meaning, was this a public knowledge? It doesn't seem so from when they returned to Beis Lechem. It seems that in some sense, they are shunned. And if they're shunned to a certain degree, why is that there? Maybe it's this lurking in the background shadow of that Bnei Israel can't marry Moabites. So you have to wonder to what degree they knew this or not. Or maybe this is being made known. So that's a separate thing to conversion, though, just to accentuate that. We're discussing right now did Rus and Orpah accept Judaism, or as it was being part of the nation of Israel at this point in time? At this point or early on? So, and the second thing is this shadow in the background is about not being able to intermarry at all with this nation. Yes?
When we think of conversion today, we think of Rabbanim being involved, and we think of mikvahs. So, what was it then? Who would have been involved?
Okay, so they're just, in general background, there are three components. There are three components of a regular conversion. And it happens to be that today the format is in front of a Beis Din, in front of a court of law. But the three basic components are, for a man it would be Bris Milah, but for everybody it would mean acceptance of the yoke of mitzvahs. That means to say, obviously, knowing enough, obviously not everything, but knowing enough to be able to say, yes, I'm committing to that and whatever else I'll be told. And number three is the mikvah. Okay, so in terms of it's really the middle one, about the acceptance of the yoke of mitzvahs, which is the more complex one to pin down, to know about, which is today, where there's a lot of the controversy that exists around conversions in America in general, is centered around to what degree do you expect people to commit, to how much they need to know at the beginning, what are the basic tenets. That's where the complications, without getting too far afield, come from. That today is done in the context of Beis Din, because they're in charge of ascertaining and confirming those rites. It could have been that earlier on, these three things, or these different components could have been reached perhaps in a different field. Because you're right, we're not in the context of Beis Din at this point.
Have you had a thought? Or?
No,
it's not.
Sorry.
Balboa, you think he was happy or unhappy about, obviously we know, unhappy. Do you know what he did? She was a demise of all of Governor Mel's family, because of her becoming a heiress.
Correct. So you're right. So what Esther's bringing up is just historically is that David HaMelech, when he was a refugee, he was concerned for the safety of his family from Shaul HaMelech, and ironically felt that Moab was a safer place, left his family, then his family were murdered in Moab. So what Esther's arguing is that may have been as a outcome of the fact that this original unhappiness. I really don't know. I don't know if that's... It could just be that Moab and Israel were old enemies. It's a possibility. We don't know. We don't know about one can imagine. One can only imagine about that, but I don't really fully know. What was that? If you see that, I'd be very interested to see that. I really would be interested to see that long-term relationship. Yes, Sally.
When the girls married the boys of this important man, don't you think he would have had something to say about them marrying out of the religion or out of the religion?
Was that he died before?
So how about
right.
Naomi?
So we see, we don't know too much about what Naomi's thoughts are. And you see what Sally's bringing up of here is the point I want to get back to in just a moment, is that we have to think about it from the perspective as well of how did this happen in the first place? What was going on in the first place? You know, in the earlier point. Now, I just want to backtrack for a moment, because the point that we started with was trying to analyze before even appreciating the process as a whole. I'd like to just take a step backwards to the actual original conversion. When did it take place? It says, if you wouldn't mind just turning in the source books to page 7, the approach which seems most tenable and is adopted by most of the Mefarshim, by Rashi and the Malbim, primarily, is the following. It is the approach that when did the conversion really take place is when the discussion takes place, and takes place at the following point. This is Rashi in source 2. And this is on page 7, Rashi in source 2 at the bottom of the page. I just want to start from the second line. Near the end it says, Lefi. Lefi shelo hayu lemachlon v'chilion kedushin bohen. Machlon and Chilion weren't actually technically married to them, in we'll call it the sense of technical Jewish marriage. Shenachrios hayu, they were at that point in time not a part of the nation of Israel. V'loinis gairu, and they did not convert yet. V'achshav hein ba'os l'hisgayer k'mo sheneemar, ki itach nashuv la'amech me'ata niyeh la'amechad. That they're saying, let us be returned to your nation. This is the point of conversion, says Rashi. And similarly, as we saw last week on the bottom Rashi on this page, Rashi explains that the whole conversation that Naomi and Ruth are having, what is Ruth responding to every time she says, I'll walk with you, I will go with you, I'll dwell in the same place as you? She is responding to specific halachas that Naomi is throwing at her in regard to the Gerus process, meaning that second portion that we discussed before, that the acceptance of the yoke of mitzvahs, what was Naomi doing? She was throwing out various halachas, random halachas, which affect very different walks of life, and her Yerusha's response was, yes, 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 to each of those, and I will accept all of these, which means that what, according to Rashi, is going on is the Gerus. It's right now, Naomi is giving her those particulars. And similarly, just flipping the page to source 4, the Malbim suggests, over here, even further than this, the Malbim suggests when they actually got married to this, what Sally was speaking about, Vayisa'u, they married, this is source 4, Vihinei Habanim, the children, or the sons, Hosifu Lachta, the sons continued to sin on what their father had. He left Israel, what do they do? Bameshinosu Nashim Moavios. They married Moabite women. Shiloi giru oisan, and they didn't convert them. Komosha kosev imidrash, v'alzeh shem o'echad arpa, ki b'geiruson hayu meshanin es shem hakoidem. In fact, he suggests that they when a person has a geirus, they have the opportunity of choosing a name or changing a name. V'hem nisharu. He suggests that these were their original names. V'gamze mevuar milashon v'yisu'u. He suggests that the word vayisu'u, used for marriage in this context, is indicative of the fact that this wasn't a halachic marriage. Sha'al lekicha b'kiddushin kadas bo'loshon lekicha. When you have the technical word for marriage, the word the Torah usually uses is the word lekicha, vayikach, and he took, or vayikhu, they took. The word it uses over here is vayisu'u. Vayisu'u, he understands, means to say, maybe a form of union. maybe a form of commitment, but not technically kiddushin, not the technical sense of marriage, because they weren't Jewish yet. And he points out that this term Vayesu is used in Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, where there was a lot of assimilation when the nation of Israel returns to Israel from Babel, and the word used over there is Vayesu. So that's the way the Malbim understands it, following through from Rashi in 12th century all the way through to the Malbim much later on in the 19th century. This is the major approach of the Rishonim. However, we should make it known that the Ibn Ezra cannot fathom this. The Ibn Ezra coming immediately after Rashi doesn't accept the notion that in the first place that this could even happen. Albeit Elimelech is not there. But how would Naomi allow the assimilation to this degree, and it seems like there's a very short time period, to the degree that her sons are marrying out without the requirements of conversion? Says then Ibn Ezra in source 5, this is in source 5 in the second line, starting near the end, Vahamo Avios. Right? Vahamo Avios, these Moabites, Mutaros li Israel, they were allowed to marry Israel, like Ki Hakasuv lo Asar Ki Mamoni Umoavi. This is the point that Leo is making. The verse only made prohibited the males of these two nations, Shelo Yavau Bikal, they shouldn't enter the nation, Shelo Yikru Bimunos Israel. So he points out, first of all, they're allowed to get married in terms of the halacha. And number two, at the end of the second paragraph in source 5, the last line, v'lo yitachen, it is not possible, sheyikcha machlon v'chilyon elu hanashim ad shnisgairu. It's not possible that they married out so fast. V'ha'ed el amo v'el elo heha. That when Naomi tries to dissuade, when Naomi tries to dissuade Orpah and Ruth coming, she says, return to your nation and your gods. Meaning, return. This is now going back because they're already Jewish, says the Ibn Ezra. That's the way he understands it. And to be quite honest, both these values are in tension, if you think about it. On the one hand, it sounds like the Geirus process is occurring right now, like Rashi and the Malbim suggest. But at the same time, it does sound like something must have gone on beforehand, although we don't see it. We see from the way that Naomi relates to them, it sounds like something must have gone on before. So we have these two time periods in tension, which leads some of the later sources. I actually saw a quote in the name of Ramosh Sternbach that perhaps maybe there was a bit of both. I think this is very tenable. There was a little bit of both. At the beginning, they said, you know what? These are wonderful young men. We'd love to marry them. It requires acceptance of Judaism. Sure, but they didn't really fully know what they were getting themselves into. When does it come to fruition? When does it really kick in? Is when they need to make a decision at this point in time between lifestyles. Now's the point that the full Geirus takes effect, in a sense, is at the point where they're now forced to make a decision about where they're going to be in the future. It's more than just the acknowledgement at this point in time. So perhaps there's a truth in both. Perhaps there's a truth in both stages, which I think makes sense in terms of just looking at this from a holistic perspective. Tina, what are your thoughts?
And are you allowed to tell a true Geir to leave and go back to your Avodah?
Absolutely not. So it sounds like whatever the acceptance was at the beginning, it was more of an acknowledgement rather than a Geirus. It was more of a form of acquiescence, but it didn't necessarily mean anything enough until this point. So obviously there was a discussion, and obviously they had that meeting at around the kitchen table after the kids were asleep, you know, like, and they discussed what's gonna be, and there was an acknowledgement, but that wasn't the meat and potatoes of everything yet until the point that we needed to force, which is why she could even have this discussion of sending her away, which is, as you point out, is a very very harsh statement in that context. Then once we had that discussion already, yes.
It's interesting that you said that they didn't change their names, because both of their names hinted to something in the future, that Orpah turned her neck and that Ruth, the Gematria, is her name.
Correct. So there's a lot of interesting things about the names. A lot of other people suggest, the Mamlo Ayes brings a number of people who suggest that they actually change their names to the names they have, but not clear either way. It could be that there's significance in their names retrospectively as well. It was yes.
I'm just curious, how did their father, who was so poor, allow both of his daughters and the princes marry two commoners?
These aren't commoners. That was what we pointed out. They were Ephratim, and Ephratim were very important people. So we're talking about it seems so. It seems that, as you pointed out last week, when they left, the point that the fact that the Megillah takes the time to talk about their leaving as significant means to say that there was a hole left, there was a gap left. So it means to say that they obviously were an important part of the Moabite society. They integrated pretty well. That's what it seems like from what we're being told.
Moab accepted them, which is
correct.
He's a king. That's the question.
How do we? Right. We don't know. We don't know the Moabite policies enough. We don't know if they were fully accepted. It sounds like they were an important part of society. More than that, it's hard to know. More than that, it's hard to know. What I'd like to do, last comment.
Just do it quickly. So Ruth is not a Jewish name.
Possibly, possibly not. According to the Malbim, it sounds like not. But according to the Malbim, it suggests a number of things that this was the name she actually only received afterwards, which is fascinating. Okay. So, but irrespective, it could be that this may have been a name which was, we'll call it, in the divine plan, a very significant name. And there are many, many names which are not Jewish, which are part of our culture, and very many prominent and important people are called by. So that shouldn't be something to raise eyebrows in either direction. What I'd like to just do is now to actually focus a little bit. Because if you think about this, just in terms of what's... This is just in terms of the basic timeline. That was just a basic timeline point. Now let's get a little deeper. Okay, let's take it to the next level. The first point to understand over here is that Rus has got a commitment. She has found a form of truth in her life, and one has to think first of all why she would be committed to the degree that she gives up everything she has. To the point that she's willing to go to a foreign nation, a nation which will shun her initially. For this. Moreover, as you pointed out, 75% of the people, the Jews she knew, were killed. Right? They didn't end up having a very good life. And there's only one quarter of the people she knew are the people that she clings to, which is Naomi. And somehow she finds the truth in that. So one has to understand Ruth, the psychology of Ruth. Now, more than that, think about this for a moment. And this is actually a point that Ruth made a few weeks ago, and I actually found in a book called Nachal Yosef, if I'm not mistaken, quoted in the Mamloes, that the first thing we just should think about is this means to say that the relationships that Rus and Orpah had with their husbands must have been very good relationships. We don't know anything about the relationship. We know about the way in which they were taken early, owing to the actions or from the retrospective position. We don't know anything about the relationships except the fact that their wives were so dedicated to the memory that they were prepared. And one of them, in fact, did come all the way to a foreign land on their behalf to propagate their name, which is a fascinating thing. It says a lot about the family in terms of their social interaction, number one. That should be on the table. Also, it says a lot about Naomi herself. Naomi means pleasant, beautiful. And the Gemara comments that her actions were ne'imim. Her actions were beautiful. That also had an impact on Rus. But it requires a little more than that. It requires a little more than that because it gets down to this point. Is that we are expected, the Torah expects us to form a relationship with God. Right? V'ahavta es Hashem lakecha. You shall love your God. Now, it's very hard to forge a relationship with somebody who's at a distance from you. You know, if you're certainly keeping a relationship, you know, from people who are across the sea is very difficult in terms of time, it's getting to be with them. Certainly forging a relationship with somebody who's far away. Certainly forging a relationship with somebody you can't have an interaction with on a day-to-day basis is an exceptionally difficult thing to do. The avenue, and one avenue of there's two major avenues. One major avenue of being able to create this relationship is being able to understand what makes him tick. His agenda, his dreams, his aspirations. Where do we find that? We find that in the Torah. The Torah is Hashem's, in a sense, it's what he wants from this world. It's what he wants from us as individuals, where he wants the world to be going. That's trying to understand his dreams, aspirations, and wills and wants. To the degree that the Gemara in Shabbos says that the first, we just did our Aseres HaDibros, that the letters Anochi, Hashem Elokecha, Anochi is an acronym for the words Ana Nafshai Kasivas Yahivas, which means, in Aramaic, I, my soul, wrote in it. Meaning, the soul, so to speak, of God, the essence of his ideology is expressed in the infinite core of Torah, which means to say a way of accessing that relationship is via what? Is via the Torah. But now you have to be careful, because there's two ways of accessing that, if we think about it. There's the cerebral, and there's the emotional. There's two ways of accessing that information. You could be an expert. You could learn all about the agenda. You could learn the Torah from A to Z. But you may not necessarily act on it, because it doesn't necessarily have that emotional component. And you may have the emotional component that you're dedicated, but if you don't have the nuts and bolts, if you don't know how it works, you could be trying very hard, but you're just walking along the wrong road. You need to have a combination between knowing what's expected in this relationship, knowing what is important in this relationship, and also the commitment to that relationship. And let's think about this for a moment. We have Rus over here. Rus, when you look what is making her make this decision. The Megillah doesn't talk about high and lofty principles. It tells us more about her dedication to Naomi. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you'd think that if we were to take this as the prototype of Gairus, then you'd think that she would have this. She would have a soliloquy talking about her dedication to God. She does mention Elokeich Elokai. But that's a detail in a greater conversation of wherever you go. Wherever you dwell. Wherever you die, I'll die. Right? I'll be buried with you. It sounds like a very integral connection, an endearing connection to Naomi, more than necessarily Hashem at the outlook. But that's exactly the point. Because where do you get the combination of both the cerebral and the emotional? You get it when you can see somebody, when you can see a role model or somebody you want to be like, because they express it for you. She is looking, this is effectively a way of growth. If people are lucky enough in life, they can find, we'll call it role models. And a role model is somebody who you can see that in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, is the way I would like to be. Obviously, there's going to be differences, and the characters are, your characters are different. But you can say, this is somebody I'm aspiring. This is a place, a finite expression of what I want to be. So what's happening over here? Rus is dedicating herself not only just to the intellectual knowledge of the Torah, not just to intellectual understanding of God, but the very practical expression of it as it finds itself expressed in the actions of Naomi, which are Maaseha Ni'imim, her beautiful actions, because it doesn't just mean something in the mind, it means something in the day-to-day life which she's attaching herself to. So when she's making this acceptance, when she's putting this on the table, what is Ruth really doing? She's showing a commitment to more than just the ideal, because she could work away and still keep the ideals in her head, but she decides to keep the actions as well. So let me take this further. Just a break, and Leah, and then we're going to take this to the next level. Correct. So one aspect of that, that's an important point of what Asei Lecha Rav can mean. It can also mean, and it certainly means, intellectually too. But what you're pointing out is that it's also a vista in to a certain way of life, which one would potentially like to be part of. So that is a very important part of us, what Asei Lecha Rav, on the grander sense of it. But let's take it further. Yeah, sure. Speculation. I can't say right. I can't say not. In a moment, I'm going to actually mention a Vilna Gaon who addresses it in the opposite direction, showing that that's not the case. But again, it's speculation because we don't know. We're not told about that. It seems like the commitment is something which is a difficult thing for her to do, which means it's a pull, and we'll see that in just a second. So, let's take it to the next level. I just want to read for you two interesting passages in the Torah itself. Take a little bit of back into history. This is the end of Parshas Noach. The end of Parshas Noach says the following. Vayichi Terach is a list of 10 generations between Adam and Noach. And the last over here of the 9 and 10 are Vayichi Terach Shivim Shana. Terach lived 70 years. Vayolad es Avram es Nachar ves Haran. He has three children. Child number one is Nachar. Number two is Avram, Nachar, and Haran. Vayolad told us Terach. Terach holid es Avram es Nachar es Haran. So he had these three children. Vaharan, Halidas Lot. Who was Haran's son? Lot. Interesting. Vayamas Haran al panei terech aviv be'eretz molad ato be'ur kastim. And Haran dies in his father's presence, or in the lifetime of his father, in Ur Kasdim. And we know that the Midrash associates that with the trial in which Haran jumps into the fire when Avram survives, and he does not survive himself. Very fascinating discussion in and of itself. And then, Vayikach Avram v'nachar lahim nashim. So Avram and the two remaining brothers marry wives. Shem Eshes Avram Sarai, v'shem Eshes Nachar Milkah, bas Haran, avi Milkah, avi Yiskah. So Avram marries a person called Sarai, and Nachar marries somebody called Milkah. Milkah was the daughter of Haran, the deceased Haran, who was the father of Yiskah. Who's Yiskah? The Midrash says that Yiskah herself was Sarah, which means, think about this for a moment, let's think about the story. We have three brothers living together. One of the brothers die. He has two daughters, Milkah and Yiskah. Who marry them? The remaining brothers. Think about this. In terms of what's going on in terms of a Yibum paradigm, this is almost the reversal of Yibum, in a sense. Haran's name is now floating in the air. Is it going to be dead? Is he going to continue? What does his brothers do? They continue his name by marrying his daughters. Very fascinating. So now let's think about this for a second. Haran now is therefore the patriarch of the matriarchs, right? And more than that, we know the end of Parshas Vayera, when it talks about Milka's descendants, who's Milka the grandmother of?
Rivka.
And Rivka's brother, Lavan, has Rachel in there, which means the matriarchs of Israel are effectively the descendants of Haran, the dead brother. I want to just get a flow for this because we were running out of time. So there's the flow over here is that Haran produces the matriarchs of the nation of Israel. Isn't it fascinating that Ruth comes from whom? From Ammon and Moab, who are the sons of Lot, who is the son of Haran. So here you see a similar pattern emerging as well. Now you have the mother of the continuation of the nation, the continuing of the nation, coming also from Haran. This is Haran now in his grave continuing through the story itself. But it gets more than that. Because if you think about it for a second, there's another story which should also raise our eyebrows at this point in time, and this is in Parshas Lech Lecha. After they ascend from Egypt, Avram and Lot and his wife Sarai ascend from Egypt, they have a lot of money. What happens? We have a particular situation over here. The Gamla Lot Ha'oleches Avram Hayatzonu V'Karvo'alim. Lot had much money, lots of tents, lots of flocks. The land could not bear them together. Ki Yeruchusham Rav V'lo Yachlu L'Sheves Yachtov. They were not able to stay together. By the way, these are very similar words to the words used, this is a Rabbi Foreman point, is in Yibum, Ki Yeshvu Achim Yachtov, when two brothers dwell together. Here it is, two brothers are not able to dwell together. So one should just be aware of what's going on, what is emerging in this quarrel. Vayhi Riv ben Ro'eh Mikne Avram ben Ro'eh Mikne Lot, Vaknani Vaprizi Oz Yashev Aretz. There was a fight between them. Vayomra Avram el Lot, Al no tihi meriva ben yuvanech ben ro'ah ben ro'echa, ki anashim achim anachnu. Let's not make a fight, we are brothers. Halo chol ha'aretz lefonecha, yiparna me'alai ima haya, smol ve'imino ve'ima yamin, as me'ila. Avram says, let's not make a fight. There's lots of space. We can both live in serenity, but not necessarily right next to each other. And what does Lot do? Lot accepts the proposition. Lot says, you know what? It's fine, and he moves to Sodom later to be saved. You have the son of Haran, a potential link in the chain of the matriarchs of the nation, who decides, yes, I will move away from the Abrahamic dynasty, from the legacy of Avraham. And the Vilna Gaon points out that, in fact, the tikkun of that story is our story. Where you have the daughter, the great-great-granddaughter of that Lot, of that prodigy of Haran, who was supposed to be part of the chain, moving away from the mainstream, moving away from being part of the nation of Israel. And here, when told the same proposition effectively, go back, she clings. Rus fixing that same incident, but it's more than that. Because if we think about it, in the context of the first section of what we just discussed, that's exactly what's going on. Did Lot reject monotheism? No. There's nothing to suggest that Lot rejected monotheism. What was he rejecting? He was rejecting the lifestyle. Lot could quite comfortably live with the ideals of Abraham in Sodom, but he chose, I don't want to cling to you and live that lifestyle. What does Ruth say? I could live just the ideals by returning to Moab, but I want the lifestyle. I want to attach myself to this nation and become not just in the mind, I want to be able to be attached in the very life, no matter what it takes. And that's why, coming back to the point mentioned earlier, that Valerie mentioned, is the Vilna Gaon says that what was the point when Naomi realized that Ruth was for real, that Ruth really realized this is now, she really means it, is in the words, Vatere ki misametes hilaleches, that she sees that she was really straining to walk. What does that mean? That means to say that Naomi looked at Ruth. Ruth is a young lady, but she's straining to keep up. This is the pasuk. This pasuk can be found in the pasuk Yudches, the last one of the section. When she was straining, this could mean, as we understood on a simple level, that she's really willing. But the Vilna Gaon says, no. There was a strain. There was a burden, because she's a young lady. She has a whole life ahead of her. She has wealth behind her. She has family. She has the potential of a new life, and yet there's the truth which she's trying to cling with. And it's a struggle. Misametzes, she's straining. And at that point in time, Naomi realized, she is straining just like Lot was straining. Lot had a lot of money. Lot had a whole life ahead of him. And he decided to adopt that life, leaving God in the cerebral, in the mind. Whereas, Ruth, with the same strain, she could live the good life, makes the decision and says, no. I want to stay with you. Then that's why Vatechtal the Daberimo, that she did not want to. She should not continue the conversation. And that's perhaps why. Just to finish with this, it says there's a very fascinating two lines in the Gemara in Bava Basra on Daf Tzadi Aleph, which says the following: that when it says over here, Dvorim v'hadvorim atikim. These matters are ancient, or matters of antiquity. Dvarim alalu atik yomayo amran. The old one of destiny, meaning Hashem had said these words. Dirsiv matzasi David avdi. The pasuk says in Shmuel, I found David my servant. Uksiv, and it says shnei benosecha hanimtzois, your two daughters who are found, referring to the conversation of the angels with Lot. The angels turn to Lot and say, get out of here. Get out of here. Take your two daughters who are nimtzaos, who are found. That's the same word used later on to be matzasi, I found David my servant. Meaning, the angels are saying, Lot, you moved off the path. You separated yourself from the lifestyle of Abraham. But hanimtzaos, you still have potential. You still can reconnect. You're going to be extracted from the destruction of Sodom because you have two daughters who are nimtzaos, who are going to produce somebody who's going to be in the same situation but make the decision otherwise. And is going to rejoin being part of the nation, but not only being part of the nation, being the matriarch of the nation. Like Sarah, like Rivka, like Rachel and Leah, who come from Haran, Rus rejoins, bringing back the legacy of Haran into the nation of Israel. We'll stop there for today.